I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is the Nokomoto Podcast, episode number 137. All right, coming to you from Nokomoto Headquarters, which is also Moto One Podcast Network Studios. I'm your host, Moto G Pete, and with me is your other host, Swiggy.
Yep.
You know, I was throwing rocks at the president of the Moto One Podcast Network's office window today. Well, like little pebbles, you know, because I had him install that Zen rock garden on the roof. So I just took like a handful of the pebbles and I just sat in a, well, I tied a stool to one of the segues that I had him buy us. And then I sat there like practicing my balance as I threw pebbles at the window until he came out and shouted at me. I'm trying to get him to quit. Anyway, so we did not have one of our 300 days of sunshine because it was just as cold and miserable as like a lot of places are right now. It seems like everywhere is super cold. What a shocker. It's February. But let's see here. We are going to do in this episode emails, but that's going to be at the end. And before emails, at some point, we're going to talk about the upcoming MotoGP season because, well, there's news about there not being news. There's news of things that aren't going to happen. There's suggestions of what might happen. It's an odd form of news about the MotoGP season. And we're going to talk about getting into dirt bikes, and we're going to do best worst bike. I don't think we have any corrections or omissions for this episode, do we?
Sort of, but I think it all can wait till emails.
It can wait till emails? Okay. We'll do a mini corrections and omissions post other content. Okay, so that takes us into best worst bike in the world this week, right?
I think it does.
Okay. So here's how this works. This is the signature segment. This is best worst bike in the world this week. Each week we each take a different bike that we have chosen and we alternate who is which, and we decide one is going to be the best bike in the world this week and one's going to be the worst bike in the world this week. It's just a fun way to look at a couple different bikes in a way you might not normally do it. Now, you might disagree with the worst bike or the best bike, and that's okay. You're entitled to your opinion. But if you're going to get your feelings hurt and you have to send an email to contact@nokomotopodcast.com, okay, just remember, oh my gosh, I've forgotten the thing that I came up with before the show for this. It was, oh geez, it was a good one. It was a good one. Fuck. Ooh, what were we talking about just before we started this? We were watching that YouTube video. It reminded me.
Ooh. Ducati?
I was thinking about that VTuber.
Okay. Mm,
it had nothing to do with what was it, Code Miko. It had nothing to do with that, but that triggered me to think of what this one was.
Max Headroom?
No, it wasn't Max Headroom. Jeez, we can't move on until I remember this. We're at an impasse. Oh fuck. It was, I said just remember why. Oh, okay. Well, now here's another one I just made up on the fly. Just remember that Michelob Ultra has only 2.6 carbs and there's no crying in motorcycles. So, Swiggy, you have best bike in the world this week.
I do.
Are you ready to reveal it?
I am.
Okay. And the best bike in the world this week is?
The Honda Rebel 1100.
Okay.
And
somewhat controversial.
I don't think it is. I think this is just purely, you know, just on the fundamentals.
Well, I agree. I love the concept.
Okay, so I guess I should pull up a picture here, but it's not really important.
Now, a lot of people sort of enjoy the concept of this, but really can't get past the styling. And I'm less concerned with the styling. I love what the bike is. It's kind of an Indian Scout style little power cruiser.
It is. Now, if you're looking at all the different pricing, the pricing for it is over 10 grand only for the dual clutch model.
Yeah, it's kind of a bargain bike as well.
So, so for this bike, it's like $9,400 MSRP.
Yeah, and it's what, high 80s on the horsepower? Like 88, something like that?
Like 89.
Okay.
Yeah.
With a shit ton of torque. It's kind of like a Guzzi Grizzo kind of numbers.
It is. Now, this is... There is one like mental block that somebody would have to get past to buy this, but it's really, this is something that's only afflicting the older generations, is simply the fact that it's not a V-twin and that it's a parallel twin. But with the parallel twin, there's actually more that you can do to customize this bike. There's more you can do with having the airbox and not having the full V motor on display. There's all sorts of stuff you can do with the frame and the tank. And it's all so much more flexible with the engine configuration. And ultimately, you may just be, you know, like somebody who would buy a Scout 60. You look at this bike and you realize, oh, I can do all the same things, and if I'm not attached to this faux heritage styling, I can make it what I want it to be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like in sport bikes, we're always, for no good reason, tied to some sort of racing class, right? And in cruisers, we're always, for no good reason, tied to some sort of nostalgic styling idea.
Well, I'm so okay with this.
This
I'm okay
is breaking. In... This is sort of the Ninja 636 of cruisers.
Well, okay. So I'm actually very much okay with that, as long as there is some function behind the form. Like, with a lot of sport bike styling, there is this necessity in that it's actually, there's an aerodynamic element to it that's necessary for it to perform the job. And, you know, the form is derived from the function itself. I'm cool with that. With a lot of, like, the classic, you know, with Harley, with the sport heritage stuff, it's all derived from this weird sort of dog and pony. I'm going to kill that real quick.
Okay. Well, here, I've got a quick interjecting point. Plenty of other shows, not just podcasts, YouTube channels, and whatever, have openly declared this a failure before it's even started. A lot of people have looked at the styling, looked at whatever aspect of it, and these exact words have been mentioned. Well, it could have been good, but it doesn't meet my expectation of what a thing Honda should have done in this precise way or whatever. There's a lot of closed-mindedness when it comes to this. A lot of this closed-mindedness coming from people suspiciously or unsuspiciously, however you want to think about it, over 40 or 45. This is not a bike for old people.
Right.
So they need to shut the fuck up and let young people buy it.
Well, there's an element to this of, you know, getting back to, you know, Crufts. There's, it's like, With sport bikes, when it's function over form, and then form becomes function, there's an element that becomes beautiful because it fulfills this role, and then the engineering to make it all work together, and there's a meaning behind it that's important. Then there's a lot of like sport heritage stuff, and a lot of weird stuff makes it in that doesn't really fit because it's trying to fit into this preconceived idea that doesn't transfer to the modern age, where it's like, oh, we've only got two Rhodesian Ridgebacks with the genetic deformity making the hair go the other way. I guess we're drowning six puppies today. Like,
yeah.
Let's stop drowning the puppies, okay? Let's
stop drowning the puppies.
Well, and now and the other angle here is, you know, this is a significantly high horsepower for the categories.
And especially for the price.
Well, I mean, this beats out the Scout 60, both in terms... it's slightly more expensive, but, like, cost per horsepower and to weight ratio is still way better.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a Honda. So it's not like you're not going to be able to get aftermarket parts for it. It's not like you can't modify it. It's not like you're not going to have a million and one different fabricators who are going to start making custom stuff for this. It's something that you will be able to modify to be exactly what you want it to be.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people are underestimating the Rebel 300 and 500 in this. I've seen them in the real world. They are very approachable, entry-level, cheap motorcycles. And whatever old people want to fucking think about this, the new Rebel 300 and 500 were plenty of people's first bike. Okay? Guess what? Harley-Davidson tried it with the 500 and 750. They couldn't make it work because they had too much of their own culture working against them. But it was a feat that Honda was able to pull off very easily. Honda must have looked at the Harley-Davidson 500 and 750 street models and gone, oh, that's cute. Yeah, but stand back. Watch us pull this trick off. And they did, okay? People thought the Grom was going to be an incredible disaster. And it's Honda's bestseller. It's right. A whole motorcycle force in and of itself. The Grom basically invented a new category of motorcycle. Or at least rebirthed it, like, completely from zero.
Okay, so I have a concept here.
Well, the closing thought on this is Honda knows what the fuck they're doing. This isn't some weird gamble. Honda knows who's going to be attracted to this, who it's for. It's so easy to make because they've got these motors around all over the place. And they're just going to continue to put it in more models. It's not expensive for them to do. And for all these people that don't like the styling, that want to poo-poo and complain this, who's asking you to buy one? All right? Old people, get out of the fucking way.
So I have a concept for the Rebel, which is a little bit ironic given the name. Because the Rebel makes a statement. And it makes a statement in the same way that not having any tattoos makes a statement.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. At this point, the Sportster 1200 or 883 iron or whatever is the sleeved out hipster bartender, and it's past its sell by dates. You're exactly right. You're making a way bigger statement without tattoos.
Yeah. I don't know where to go from here.
Yeah, I think we summed it up. Yeah, it's the 883 Sportster, or 1200 Sportster, but with way more power secretly and no tattoos, and that's what's so attractive about it. Yeah. Okay, cool. All right, are you ready to move to worst bike in the world this week?
I am.
Okay. And the worst bike in the world this week is any animal-shaped or themed motorcycle.
I kind of like the Jaguar motorcycle.
I hate it. I hate it so much. You know how you can go into YouTube and put, like, insert, like, any animal versus any animal and find a video of those animals fighting?
Oh, there's a whole, like, Animal Planet show on it.
Right. Yeah, whatever
the versus CGI whatever. And everything.
Yeah. So it turns out that you can put in, like, snake motorcycle, you know, lion motorcycle, like almost any creature you can think of. Like, here, right now, let's go into Google. Let's name an animal.
Badger
motorcycle. Let's go to the image search. Image. Well, I've got a person dressed as a badger on a motorcycle. But, I mean, really, like, truly.
Are we talking about just animal-shaped or animal-themed?
Either, but really the animal-shaped one. So just let's just do animal motorcycle to start with. And all this nonsense comes up. So there's a few categories of these. So the most offensive category I find is the motorcycle where the bodywork, and I call this, the Jaguar company motorcycle is one of the best representations of this, but so is this Red Bull motorcycle. This is where they take the body of the motorcycle and construct an animal shape around the frame. And often it somehow involves the forks and all kinds of things. These things frequently have no suspension. They're just disasters. They're not really meant to move. No one's meant to ride them. They probably just sit in some corporate headquarters somewhere. But that doesn't stop people doing their own homebrew versions. And of the homebrew versions, a very popular version of this, this really is its own category, and these are the skeleton motorcycles, where people have affixed real or fake bones along the frames of the motorcycles.
I mean, this is such...
There's the skin motorcycles, where people have taken bear rugs or alligators or whatever else and fashioned those, usually just across the tank, the handlebars, the head, and the seat and tail. So it's kind of like an animal sitting on top of the bike.
Yeah.
That's its own other category of this.
I would love to hang out with a person who owns, like, a leopard print Hayabusa. I just don't ever want them to get my phone number or my address.
Well, the animal print bike is definitely a category of this. It's one of the weaker ones. This is an interesting one, this category, which is the mythical creature motorcycle, where the bike is supposed to look like some sort of creature, but you're not really sure what. It's just the bike's just sort of vaguely monster shaped.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and then, yes, there's just the animal print motorcycle. Close relative of the 90s fuzzy bike.
Yeah.
Okay. And here's another great mythical creature one. sometimes, yeah, they look like the motorcycle's made to look up like a dragon or something that's got a whole tail to it. Okay, so what is the whole point of this? Why would somebody do this? Because, again, this is one of those things that if you're into motorcycles, inevitably, at some point during your working life, someone will walk up to your workstation and show you a picture of one of these on your phones, on their phone. They'll be like, hey, you like bikes, right? Get a load of this. Okay? And they're like, if I was going to have a bike, I'd have one like this. That's pretty cool, huh? These are always the worst. They will never say anything else. There are 17-year-old girls showing you a picture of an animal-shaped motorcycle that will start talking in this voice. Okay? It's just a thing that happens.
So, now I'm getting a little bit of a vibe here, which is, were you hurt recently? Has this been happening at work lately, Peter?
Okay, look.
No, I understand that, yes, there is a segment of... There is this super weird, very visual element of bike culture that's super, that's incredibly superficial, that somehow leaks out, and that's all that, at a particular moment, society at large has an impression of the motorcycle world of, and then it just become, and that's just all you get if you're known as the motorcycle person in your place of work.
So it's not that's really bothering me. What bothers me is it really cheapens the very idea of a motorcycle, and I'll explain. Mm-hmm. It is taking this because these bikes never have any sort of improved attributes as a result of this, right? There's universally poor lighting and turn signals, right? The steering seems very compromised in many of these designs. Certainly safety in a crash goes completely out the window. And comfort, I think many of the creators of these motorcycles don't know how to spell the word. So there's all the practicality of the machine taken out, and it's pure novelty, right? But these things exist, and especially the homebrew ones, someone might be out there semi-riding it, right? They might be taking it around to shows, whatever. But the bike is not a daily rider. It could have been, but it isn't, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of these builds that have been purchased and used at a rate of over $1 a mile of investment.
Right. And it's what it's doing is you're riding around going, hey, look at me. Right. Rather than, you know, I talk all the time about you get on a bike and the bike gives you a feeling, right? You can be this super old, out of shape, whatever, unattractive, uncool person, but you kind of put on the jacket and you put on the helmet and you get on the bike and you kind of become someone else. But more than anything, like, you're kind of separate from, you're more connected to the rest of the world, but you're also shut off from the world. You can recreate your own image. You're different things, but you and the bike are one. And you're somehow altered and changed, but you're having this experience, and it's really more about how you feel,
yes,
versus how anyone else feels.
Right.
When you ride around on this animal-shaped motorcycle, all you're looking for is validation from other people on this crazy-looking bike. has right. nothing to do with riding, has nothing to do with what motorcycles are good at, has nothing to do with what motorcycles are good for.
Right. This is purely external validation as opposed to internal validation. And yes. this is just the dialed up to 11 on external validation.
Yes.
With zero internal validation, which is exactly the opposite of what anyone gets once they actually ride a motorcycle. This is like the greatest, like this is, I'm trying to think of like a term.
It's just every time I see one of these, it feels like this active assault on the idea of motorcycles.
It is a weird sort of abomination in that it completely disregards the internal validation.
Yeah, which is really what it's all about. It's because that's what motorcycling has to be about. It has to be about your own little world. Because if you're not concerned about your own little world, you're not really focusing on the road. You're not in that flow state that you need to be riding your best. You're not doing the things, like paying attention to the right things. You're not, you know, if you're just parading up and down Main Street, it's not really motorcycling. And I know that sounds like super, I don't even know what the term is. I was about to say, like, no, it's not. I don't. It sounds pretentious. It sounds like this closed idea. Everyone should be riding the way I ride. No, this is something that you can just turn your car into an animal instead. It's going to be more effective for what you're trying to do.
I mean, if I had a transit van, I would, if for the right price, I would turn it into the dog van from Dumb and Dumber.
Right. But driving a car is such a universal experience versus motorcycle that makes a lot more sense.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess there is an element of, you know, if you look at motorcycling as an activity, and then you look at what a lot of Instagram culture has become, there's a lot of parallels you can draw between a lot of high-end motorcycles and, well, you and I have witnessed this culture on many occasions of people treating high streets like catwalks with their motorcycles. This is kind of an old Harley guy thing, which is kind of weird. This is like the one thing that 17-year-old anorexic models and 60-year-old mechanics have in common.
Yeah.
Is they both like catwalks, apparently.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, about the animal-shaped motorcycle is it's never elegant. It's the complete antithesis to what everyone else is going for in their custom motorcycle. Like, say what you want about choppers, pro street bikes, 90s fuzzy bikes, like Bo Suzoku. They're all going for a certain elegance in their own unique way. They're all, you know, whether it's modded out scooters or whatever it is,
there's no animal-shaped motorcycle that is not a bodge.
Right. It's also, what I'm going to throw into this category is the motorcycles where all the bodywork has been designed to look like you're riding some woman. You know? I don't understand that move either. And they're like, oh, but I'm going to make the arms, the forks, and the head is going to be the headlight because it's a headlight. You get it? It's not clever.
Yeah. Oh my God, it's I'm not pretty clever. Sure you're a serial killer.
Right? Oh, the whole thing is weird. The whole thing's super duper weird. I mean, Here, let's look up cheetah motorcycle. What do we get? See? Like, well, I guess that's more of a toy, but here we go. Like, ugh. There's a lot of cheetah bikes, but
people know that like cheetahs weigh like 60 pounds, right? They're not big cats.
No, they're not. What? Well, yeah. They got kind of a large frame for how much they weigh. But anyway, here we go. Yeah. You can put in almost any animal in motorcycle and you're going to find something. I mean, especially with mythical creatures, like if we put in dragon motorcycle, holy shit, what do we think is going to... This is not something I've Googled yet. Yep, there we go. Like, this looks like it should be in a Chinese restaurant.
Oh, dude, and it's hub steering as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Look at this thing. What is... Oh, there's too many pictures. We can't put all this in. But yeah, everything, like, this dude riding this dragon bike, right, where this one doesn't even make sense because the tail turns into the head. I don't know. But
he's just cruising, man.
Is he just cruising? Or does
no,
he
No, the
really...
dragon's cruising.
Yeah. And he's got a flamethrower in its
this
mouth.
This is like one-upping Bo Suzuku builds.
I mean, in a way, this does have a lot of Bo Suzuku, this particular picture in it. This might have to be the picture that I link in the show notes. This dragon bike. So yeah, like I said, it's offensive because it's not really a motorcycle anymore. You can't really use it for motorcycle things.
Yes. Technically and objectively, it is a motorcycle, but in terms of getting onto two wheels and going to ride and have fun in the experience of riding, all of that is missing from this entire equation.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break.
And move on. All right. And we're back. So let's talk some dirt bikes. More specifically, getting into dirt bikes, because I'm going to get into dirt bikes. Because it's a whole category of bikes that I just really haven't explored. Kind of like scooters was... not something I was totally unfamiliar with, but hadn't really dove into, and it's a lot of fun. Similarly, dirt's going to be the same way, but this is being really pushed by an external force, which is my daughter, because she needs an outlet. I bought her a Razor Pocket Mod scooter for Christmas, and all this kid does now is tear ass up and down the street. And she's hopping the curb. She's like hitting the gutter in a way that like she gets some air with the scooter now.
I think the best example of this is when you called me and we got interrupted by like a... trying to bargain with you to let her ride her scooter in the street while the whole street was covered by an inch of ice.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't matter the weather. She'll go out there when it's freezing. She doesn't give a shit. She just wants to go fast. And, ooh. Well, so she's got this thing, which I'm not worried really about her future, because she's got these two things. One, she's laid back and easygoing, but two, which I know doesn't make much sense because I just said all she does is tear ass up and down the street, but she is. She's very agreeable, but she has no fear of failure. Not no fear, just no fear of failure, which is a great way to be. Now, well, also, you know, like yesterday I took the kids skiing and she got stopped by ski patrol because she was going too fast. And they reprimanded her for just straight lining down the hill. And the ski patrol guy was like, you need to work on your turns. And she turned to him immediately and fired back, I know my turns. Like, given ski patrol back. Well, yeah, but she'd rather just go fast. So when we got her first bike years ago, she just took to it like a duck to water. I remember on Christmas Day when she got her first bike with the training wheels, she was just riding it in the living room, and it was only about 20 minutes before she figured out that she could twist the handlebars and pedal extra hard and swing the whole back of the bike around. She's just that way. She's keen. So I've got to get this kid a dirt bike, right? And part of it's a little selfish because I want to do it too. And also it's this thing, you know, I've said many times before, show me a kid that's worried about earning some gas money and money for some new clutch plates and, you know, some whatever other parts to upgrade the bike, right? And I'll show you a kid that's getting good grades and does not have a police record, right?
Right.
So there's that. And it's a lot cheaper than skiing. Everything's cheaper than skiing.
Yeah.
So I think I've settled on an SSR. I think the model's the SR70C. So it's a 4-speed all down. No hand clutch. It's automatic clutch, but there's still a foot shift. It's a disc brake front and back, adjustable suspension. Well, it might. I don't know if the suspension is adjustable. It's got a throttle stop. It's just all the things you want for a kid's bike. It's like a CRF50, but it's a little bit taller because she's a little too big for a CRF50 or a PW50. She's 7. So I need something a little bit taller. And I think the SR70 is the thing. I want to see.
I mean, I've ridden a CRF50.
Oh, have you?
It's hilarious.
I need it to be regular size for her if she's going to do this stuff. So there we go. So I've been looking up. I've been on Craigslist. And, of course, there's, like, nothing on Craigslist for kids' bikes right now.
Right.
Craigslist is just a barren wasteland. And the trick is, do I wait for the bottom to fall out and there to be tons of stuff on Craigslist and buy something then? Or do I just start assembling everything now and just go, you know what, I'm going to spend $900 to $1,000 on whatever it ends up being in the end with destination charge and taxes and all this crap on the SSR, right?
Right.
I think it makes sense just to get the SSR because it's only going to be like one season. Then I'll sell it for like $700 or some shit, right? And we're going to move up to the next bike. This is just something to learn the fundamentals on. But I know jack shit about riding dirt also. So I think I need a 250 four-stroke of some kind. A CRF 250F seems to be ideal. You know, but as I'm looking into it, the bike that looks the coolest to me is a Suzuki RM 250 two-stroke. But I'm told that that's not a great move. The 252 stroke might be a little bit more than I should have for learning.
Yeah, and this is where I need a little bit of, for all the people who ride dirt and street, I need a little bit of a calibration step here. Because everybody else, you know, everybody says like, oh, you know, your first street bike should be a 250. The first bike I rode on public roads was a Ducati SS800. And it was fine. Like, it wasn't a disaster. I didn't kill myself. I rode it 200 miles, like, on a permit. Like, it was It was fine. Like, what is, in terms of, like, reasonably responsible people easing into a new bike, what is the actual reasonable bike? And is it a 250? Is a 450 fine? Is, like, a DRZ 400 okay? Like, what's the real, like, for reasonable people, what is the actual reasonable first bike?
Well, it seems to be four stroke because it's much more predictable power.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the 450s are kind of stupid power because you have to, because it's not the street, it's the dirt, it's bumpy. It's like 20 miles an hour on the dirt feels like light speed because you're feeling everything, right? If you've never been on the dirt before, 20 is just going to feel way too fucking fast at first. So you don't need a lot of horsepower. You need something that's not twitchy, that's not sensitive. This is what I'm being told, but we need listeners that ride dirt to really clue in here, because I thought, well, okay, but maybe I should get something two stroke to learn on, like a 125. But I've had people tell me, well, you're gonna outgrow that really quickly. That's really for people stepping up from like an 85 cc bike. You don't want to do that. So it seems like I need to spend somewhere between $2,500 and $3,000 on some sort of decent 254 stroke. I don't know. But
I'm just coming at this from a perspective of there's probably equal amounts of bullshit in the dirt world as there is in the street world. And I'm just waiting for somebody to point out to me what that bullshit is.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely taking this plunge. And I just have a feeling that you're just going to have to follow suit. Like, you bought a scooter and then a week later I bought a scooter. You know what I mean? It's got, or maybe 2 weeks, or a week and a half, 10 days, whatever it was. Right? I think we're just going to have to jump into this. Now, I've already got a trailer, which I've had this whole time. It just hasn't been registered for a while. I've been storing Christmas decorations in it for like 3 years.
Oh, so it's the covered one.
Yeah, the box trailer.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the beaver tail.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, this is like I rebuilt this trailer, and when Dad no longer wanted it, he just gave it to me. He was like, you rebuilt it anyway. This trailer was from... So this was like a handmade trailer. Someone welded this shit up in like... I think it says 82 on the frame. Like they welded... they put 82 on the frame.
Yeah, this is like classic pickup truck style. Build the bodywork around the frame.
Right. Yeah. So this thing was like all rotted out. There were like holes in the floor and shit. And like, wow, was it like 6 years ago, I just rebuilt the whole trailer. So it's a tidy little trailer now. And get some lights in there and everything. And I think it'll hold. I think it should.
Yeah, we picked up the CB1000 in that trailer.
Oh, really? It held the CB1000?
Yeah.
I thought that would have been sticking out the back. Okay. Yeah. No, I think it'll hold two dirt bikes, at least a 250 and a kid's bike.
Yeah, yeah. Easily.
And we put straps in there or hooks in there for all kinds of straps in all kinds of different directions. There's hooks in the floor. There's hooks around the sides. It's good. And there'll be room left over for a toolbox, some fuel containers, all that kind of stuff. It's going to be perfect. And I need to order it, but I found for about $120-something a hitch kit for the Fiesta.
Yeah.
So I think I can trailer with the Fiesta. Just of course down 85. You can. Yeah.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. I'm going to get some weird looks, but it should be fine.
Yeah. Why not?
It's 90 horsepower. I would. So, yeah, I think just down 85. It's like, because the dirt bike park's only what, 35 miles away.
Is it that close?
Well, I think Fort Lupton is 25 miles. It's 25 or 35 miles exactly. And then you've just got to dart across from 85 to 25. Yeah.
I have no idea.
No one cares about this geography lesson. No. But it's definitely under 45 minutes, no matter what.
I didn't think it was that close.
Okay. Yeah, it's not far. It's really not. Well, I mean, it's only what you could hit. You can hit Westminster from here in 45 minutes, and it's definitely closer than that.
55 is realistic.
Okay. Well, anyway.
Yeah.
Firestone-Dekono is 35 to 45 minutes from here.
Yes.
Somewhere in there. Right. So it's really fucking close, right? And it's only $20 to ride all fucking day. Or what was the year pass? It was like $600 or something. You'd have to go like every day to make it worthwhile. But I don't know. Maybe there's some sort of pass that we can share. The point is that I've already got somebody who's given me a whole bunch of gear for free. It's which fucking bike? Because if I can wait a few months for the right bike to show up, right? So here is the question. What is the common wisdom? Is a if you're an experienced street rider, is a 125 pointless? Are you just wasting time? You should just go straight to a 254 stroke. Are you going to learn better on that because it's more predictable power? Or is it worth just learning to deal with the weirdness of a two-stroke?
Right. And, if obviously we're not going for performance or actual power, like in terms of like actually setting any particular set of time, just in terms of getting into it, is even like an early 90s like DRZ the right way to go?
I feel like we want to take advantage of the most modern suspension we can get our hands on.
Well, I don't know.
Well, I'm sure it's possible to buy some piece of crap from the 80s or 90s. That's
even the current DRZ 400 is still carbureted. And
I don't think that's true.
The 2020 at least is. But even then, like, what is the measure of what would make a good first bike for somebody who started with street and is transitioning to dirt? What is a reasonable option? Given that we don't care about weight, we don't care about, racing pedigree or anything like that. What is...
Oh, you're right. The DRZ is. I was thinking of the RM. Like the...
Oh, no. The RM is... Of course it is.
I love the look of the RM. I think it's the coolest looking dirt bike. I've always liked Suzuki dirt bikes. They've been on point for a long ass time. So, like the RM450. Yes. I don't know. That Suzuki blue and yellow really speaks to me. And I don't know. I love this bike. Anyway. So, yeah, cool. There's really not a whole lot to this, except that we need emails on a little bit of guidance here. What really is the sweet spot for that bike? And then...
Also, I will just drop now that after a huge, horrible financial decision, I got started on a supermoto project on a bike that ended up getting stolen, and I happened to have some Warp 9 rims for a WR450F.
I thought it was just 400.
No, the rims are actually for a 450F.
Oh, okay.
Look, you are correct. It was a WR400. This just compounds the financial irresponsibility. Yeah. I don't want to get into it right now. But if anybody knows if that will still work with a WR250 or a YC250, let me know. It's been a lot of years. I should have looked this up by now. Find someone to machine us
the right spacers. Or you could just sell them and buy something else.
Well, it's also the bearings and all sorts.
Yeah.
I'm really just broadcasting my own irresponsibility at this point.
That's fine. Well, the other question, too, is on the gear. What is the gear that where you've got to spend a little bit of coin? I've seen some O'Neill boots on Amazon for like $100, which feels a little cheap. Dirt bike helmets are kind of designed to be crashed and worn again. Like, is this an age thing? Are dirt bike helmets good for a longer period? What's the common wisdom there? You know, we've given you guys so much advice over the years. It's time to give back, because this is a whole different adventure, and that's going to roll out on the show as we get through this, right? So, okay, let's move on to MotoGP now.
We should take a break.
Should we?
We should, because I need to get some more beers.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. Okay, so the weirdness... You ready?
I'm ready.
So somewhere in the weirdness of all of this, how the world is, I think it was late November they released the MotoGP calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere about 3 weeks ago, they changed it.
Shocker.
Right. Well, I mean, there's changes in the calendar, certainly from time to time, but they quite optimistically decided they were going to do Qatar, Argentina, Circuit of the Americas, just like they normally do, with no real announcement of whether there would be attendance at these races or anything. It was kind of like last year. They just decided to go on as normal until someone called them on their bullshit going, no, that's not going to be able to happen.
In fairness, that was very early on in the pandemic. Like, nobody had any fucking clue what was happening at that point.
Right, but they decided to just create another calendar for 2021 that also didn't acknowledge.
Yeah. There were some lofty goals.
Okay. So Circuit of the Americas is out, Argentina's okay, but COTA's a better race, but whatever. Okay. So, apparently, it's such a repeat of last year, because they're doing double rounds in Qatar, which, okay, but mm-hmm. they're only doing double rounds in Qatar?
Yeah.
A curious move. I don't know what the need for that is. Why not just come back to Europe early and do another different race in Europe?
Probably because at the track in Qatar, there is a hotel in the middle of nowhere where they can isolate and get everybody to confidently start the season off in.
Okay, I didn't think about that.
I mean, I don't have anything other than that. Like, it kind of makes sense. If
that's the case, well, then why not do that and then stay there for like a month, do three or four rounds there, right? Do all of the early sort of pre-flyaways. Be there right all the way through April.
Well, they are kind of doing that because they're doing all the testing there as well. So they are basically going to be in Qatar for a month.
No, but push it. Push it till the third week of April, because you're just buying yourself more time to guarantee that all your people are isolated and totally cool until you go to Europe, right?
Well, the standard is 2 weeks, and that's all they're going to do, I'm guessing.
Anyway.
I mean,
so...
Yeah, it. I mean...
But you're also buying more time for all these places to get their shit together, to get more people vaccinated, to get more things open and whatever. Because you never know when one of these countries will just decide, you know what? We're not going to have a Grand Prix after all.
Right. So it makes sense to hold your opener in a country under a dictatorship, on a track built with slave labor that needs the exposure. It all kind of works out, you know?
Okay. So weirdly, Argentina and the U.S. have been pushed to theoretically, like the cryptic, like final quarter, I think they said.
It's not happening.
Well, no, it's not happening. It's straight up not happening. It's just a lie. They said last year they might push it and do it later on. They never bothered to do it.
In late November.
Yeah, whatever. It's not happening. There is no Circuit of the Americas or Argentina race this year, which makes me float the theory. Will they drop it permanently? I really don't want that to happen, but... Are they going to do, like, there are plenty of MotoGP fans that don't particularly care for it.
I think that's bullshit. I think that's totally manufactured. We've been to MotoGP 3 years in a row. It grew every year exponentially to the point where the whole track was flooded. I think there is a big demand for it in America. It may not be big enough to saturate and have a three-track tour, you know, over the course of 2 months to fill out every single track, but there is absolutely a huge demand to completely fill out a track venue once a year. And it's insane to disregard that market.
Well, I agree that those people are there. I'm just saying worldwide, I think there's a lot of people that think real MotoGP happens in Europe and Phillip Island. And everything else is just some sort of side distraction, some sort of mini quest along the way. This is definitely the opinion of, like, Brodo GP and...
That's fucking dumb.
No. Well, I agree it's dumb. I'm just saying this is not a rare point of view. A lot of people look at Argentina and Circuit of the Americas as lesser races.
Does Europe have secret asphalt? Like, why would that be the case?
Just because those tracks are older, I think. There's some sort of more sense of tradition, and that style of motorcycle racing just has more roots on the continent. That's the entirety of it, I think. It doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah, that's a little bit of fairy tale logic.
Well, right. I'm not defending it. I'm just acknowledging that it's a thing.
Okay.
So, well, do you think there's zero likeliness that they'll cancel, that they just won't do Argentina and COTA next year? Because they'll go, well, we've gone 2 years without it. Do we really have to do it? Or do you think they'll fight back for it?
I think they'd be insane not to do it again. But at the same time, I'm not going to say that they're not dumb enough to not do it.
Okay. We don't need to explore it any further. I just wanted to make sure we asked the question because I think it's a concern some people have, and I think it's a hope some people have. But okay, so
I think we should have two tracks in America.
Oh, well, we do. We have Indianapolis. We have Laguna Seca. No, but
they should be on the calendar.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. Well, what would need to happen is we need either an entirely new track somewhere or one of the tracks to get a major fucking facelift.
Yeah.
I'd love a new track in Colorado, somewhere around Loveland, maybe down by Denver International Airport. We've talked about where there are good places for that, but whatever. No one wants to listen to us on that. Okay, so next thing with GP and its weirdness. Super late or super early silly season moves. The last we spoke about GP, Dovizioso was not officially the backup rider for Marquez. He now is, and it's really looking like it's going to be him and Espargaro starting the Repsol team.
Yeah, which is, okay, let's take a step back here real quick, and let's talk about Marquez, because apparently Marquez is still the golden child of Honda, and yet, in November, he was on his third surgery for his arm, where they discovered that his arm was not healing because he had a bone infection. Now, yeah. That's something. Okay, I understand we are in a pandemic and we can't all just go to the doctor whenever we like without any hassle, even in countries with socialized medicine. However, how does this go on for so long? How is Marquez, who crashed and broke his arm, 10 months ago?
Something like that.
How do you not heal a bone in your arm for 10 months?
Because he really fucking broke it. The break that he made.
People have had limbs reattached in a shorter period of time. This whole drama has been going on.
It's not just his arm healing like a regular broken arm. Like, it's his shoulder and his arm, and it's all got to be. He's got to regain, like, not just day-to-day function. He's got to regain a higher level of function than most people require of their limbs. And it's all, like,
I think there's some shenanigans going on here. Or some wild incompetence.
I don't think so. I think he had a really serious fucking problem. I think there are people that break their limbs in this way that just, like, get disability for the rest of their lives. I think there's people that have this kind of injury that normally they spend 6 months in physical therapy and then, yeah, their shoulder only lifts to so high for the rest of their life, you know? Their arm is just at a little bit of an angle, and they just deal with it because they're not world-class athletes. And if you're a world-class athlete, you need that shit to come back as close to 100% as possible. And that's delicate, and that takes time. Also, this whole time, he's got to be trying to use it. He's got to be trying to stay in shape, and that's going to complicate things. I think you've just got to be a doctor to really understand what's going on this one. Regardless, it doesn't matter if there's any shenanigans or not, which seems like it would be bordering on malpractice and illegal if there was. So,
I would understand.
What's more important is the implication that he's clearly not coming back at the beginning of the season. I think the smart money lies that he will not be participating in Qatar.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. But, no, like, I would understand if it was something like, oh, he totally severed a particular nerve or something, or he has actual nerve damage, then, like, oh, well, he'll never ride again. Or he'll ride again if he wanted to, but he'll never be a professional rider again. Like, that would make sense. But, like,
I think that's actually the most likely to be true. I think there's some Hail Mary surgeries kind of going on. That's just my little conspiracy theory that it's so bad. He kind of knows, but they're just, you know, he's had so many
Doctor Strange situation. Like, his hands may never work the same way again.
Yeah, I think he's earned himself so much goodwill with Honda that they're willing to just kind of watch this play out till every single last hope is gone of him coming back in any kind of competitive way.
Yeah, possibly.
And he spent so much time off the bike. There's no way he can just come back and be as good as he was. Even if you're Mark Marquez, this isn't doable. This requires like another year of just training away from everyone else, just on the bike, getting those lap times back up. It's just, I think the Marquez era is done. But I also hope I'm wrong. You know, I've been a Marquez critic. I've been an anybody but Marquez kind of guy. Absolutely. But I also recognize what he's done for the sport, what he's done and how incredible it is, how hard it is to do it. Yeah. You know, but how many times has he popped that shoulder out? How many injuries has he had to that arm? Like, how many crashes? It's taken a toll.
He's been rolling the dice a lot.
Yeah.
And at some point, yeah.
So there's Marquez. You know, really, I think we talked about some teams that were swapped around and what the lineups were at the end of last year. Now, you were talking to me and you said, well, you don't watch these, Peter, so who cares? But I guess we've had some of the livery reveals at this point. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I haven't seen any of them yet. Are any of them any good?
They're all 3% different from last year.
That's kind of what I expected because, well, business has kind of just been on pause. So the biggest reason for a big livery change is different sponsors, right?
Right.
You know, I was kind of hoping Suzuki would just realize that they needed to go back to the blue and high-vis and get rid of the gray. I don't know what they were thinking, but
yeah,
since I haven't heard anything about an awesome new Suzuki or an awesome old Suzuki livery, I'm assuming they're still out of touch with their colors.
It would be a bold move, but I kind of wish that Suzuki would just go for their dirt bike livery and just go yellow and white.
There's even still some blue in there. The Suzuki blue and yellow is strong. I like it overall, but what they had like 2-3 years ago was great. I don't know. There's no reason to change from that, but okay. And so Monster Yamaha is still in its goth teen phase, going mostly black, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah. Look.
It's all the same.
For anybody out there doing any sort of graphic design, like on the fly without any kind of formal training whatsoever, as a stylistic cue, black is a crutch. This is what gothy teenagers go for. This is this is what, like, boomer renegades go for. It will work at the most shallow level possible.
Right.
It's ultimately, you can do it on the fly, and it, at a surface level, it'll be good. Long term, it sucks.
Yeah. So you kind of asked me, like, well, you didn't ask me outright, but I explained to you why I never watch these livery reveals. And I want to put this out there because hopefully someone hears this who's in a position to do something about it. I would watch these if it was some sort of giant TV presentation like the NFL draft is or whatever. Something where all the fans get together and watch this thing that has to do with the sport outside of the season, right? And in a way, it almost is MotoGP's NFL draft because, yes, they announce the riders, but up until they do the livery reveal, the contracts don't mean shit. They change it all the time in the back. This is sort of them coming out and going, okay, we've submitted the fairing design to race officials, right? Race Tech has that. We can, you know, now only change it one more time throughout the season. All right. These are our riders. Here are the publicity shots. We now have advertisers and money invested in these riders being matched with these bikes. And that's what we're selling, right?
Yeah.
Until the livery reveal, it's all still theoretical. So in a way, it's kind of MotoGP's draft, right? Now, it's all still done on a stage in front of a group of people, right? Kind of like the draft is, more or less, with everyone.
Yeah.
And that makes sense in the context of TV. But there is no channel to watch this on, right? It's all just released on YouTube, basically, or the MotoGP website, right? So everyone watches it in 5-minute video clips. So why the fuck isn't it done in that format on a soundstage where someone comes out, explains to you, here's the livery, we get close-up shots of the bike, we get graphics pointing out what's different, who are the new sponsors, who are the main sponsor, what's sort of the tiering of the sponsors, who's throwing the money in? I'd be interested to know. Who's throwing the money in? What implications does that have for the team and their funding? I would like to know that. But even more than that, I'd like close-up shots where they show us exactly what they did change in the fairing. And I don't need any numbers on the more percent of downforce. I don't need them to give away the secret sauce. But it would be cool to go, hey, check it out. We've got some different winglets like right here. Check this out. We shortened this a little bit. You know, here we did a change here and here. Point out new versus old. That would really be something for me to watch. And then give the writers something to actually say. Or yeah. let them say what they actually think. Let them add some value, right? If they say something controversial, who gives a shit? That's just more advertising.
Right, yeah. It'd be nice to have a preseason interview of a rider who didn't say, I really like my team, they're the best team ever because they are currently paying my salary, and in the next season I like the bike because it's the bike I was given, and what I'm hoping to do this year is to go faster than everybody else so that I win races and can make more money. Can we have an interview that doesn't boil down to that subtext?
Yeah, I would love to see some writer come out there who's writing for, like, Team Grassini, who's like, this year I'm hoping to make one podium.
Right.
Like, just straight up honesty. Just, here we go. It's the Aprilia. It is the underdog of all underdogs. We're going for one podium. We want consistent top 10 finishes. We think we can accomplish it because we've made, you know, we've made power gains and we've got a better setup than we've ever had before. And oh, hey, we, you know, and also part of the livery, I'd like to like get the names of like the crew chiefs in there and maybe even a couple mechanics. Be like, hey, we just got this new like computer guy that we didn't have on the team before. That's a reason to have faith in it. Like, make it a like a fucking thing in a proper video clip format, not just you filming a press conference. Because right now you're just filming a press conference, and that doesn't make for very dynamic YouTube content. Sorry.
Yeah, so we got a glimpse of this when we were mistakenly let into the GP paddock.
Oh, yeah. Well, I kind of knew we weren't supposed to be there, and I just fudged it with the gate guy.
Yeah.
I got us in the GP paddock.
But there's like a weird culture around these events that kind of exists for itself and itself alone.
Yes.
And the final product suffers a lot for it. Like, it would be good. Like, why couldn't this be? Like, for all the money that goes into an internationally traveling motorsport event, how hard would it be to have, like, a crazy, like, 4 or 5 hour long season intro, like, contracting, like, establishing, you know, instead of having like the 5 minutes before the season starts, like before the first race of the season starts.
Oh, where they always do the cringy videos where they introduce the riders and the teams and they have them doing stupid shit like shooting bow and arrows and
or lifting weights.
Yeah. Yeah.
What if you could do that as like a 4 to 5 hour web only event? Like stream type thing that you did like 2 months earlier, and it was who's riding what changes, what are like the obvious changes on the bikes, you know, what are the new contracts, and then just tie that in with all sorts of other content around like really getting up to speed on what's actually happening in the season. Like, there's so much you could do. You could add in all the new sponsors and everything. I mean, you could easily just do an hour while cutting a shit ton of content and information. But like, why do we get all of this? This incredibly lame content.
I don't know. Well, Dorna is so split 50-50 on this because on one hand, they're so with the times that they made a clear and early split with having it just be on TV, and they got their shit together with the streaming options and across all the platforms as early as anyone else did. They got, and you know, when the pandemic hit and everything, they were doing virtual races with the riders playing video games, which, okay, not super awesome, but it was something, right?
It was an effort.
It was an effort, right? The graphics game this last season was upped a lot. You know, when you sit there and you think, okay, I'm paying $160 for this, like, you see your money on the screen, right? But then a lot of this is just filmed press conferences. Like, why is there a need to film any press conferences ever again? But no one's reading about this in magazines. You are the source. Like, why are there reporters there at all? What publications, for what? It's not like they're talking about it on CNN, right? Like, for who? And
yeah, you know, why,
let's say it's for like, you know, Road Racing Magazine Online, right? They can just play the fucking video. They could just link to the video on the MotoGP site.
It is a good question. What the journalist with a 10-degree off skew angle of the exact same performance is actually getting out, that their article will reveal that we didn't get.
Uh-huh.
Especially because this is not... Yeah, this isn't like...
it's not like the race happens in secret. And then at this press conference, we're told how it went. We all get to see it.
Yeah, there's a weird sort of like trans... like old school, like old-timey, transatlantic... like, I'm trying to think of the word...
You know, I would be more interested in these reporters or whoever getting a shot at doing their own race commentary that's released by Dorna, right? Now, the guys they've got doing it are great, and Simon Krafar is fantastic, but I would be more interested than hearing a bunch of reporters ask the same six questions after every single race. I would rather hear different people's take on the play-by-play, you know, the turn-by-turn commentary. That would be of way more value to get different personalities in to do that. You could have podcasters like us, but you could also have ex-racers do it.
That would be a terrible idea.
What?
Well, us.
Well, not specifically us. But I meant like podcast, like motorcycle podcasters or just racing podcasts, you know, people that specialize in this. That would be one thing to do. But again, ex-racers is another
Hopefully
one.
Hopefully people who know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, if Marquez can't race anymore, I'd like to see a Marquez commentary on a lot of races, right?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Exactly. Well, that would add a lot of value, and that fits into the way that this content is broadcast now, whereas a lot of it's half of it is still stuck in this TV era that doesn't make a lot of sense for the way that we consume it.
Yeah, it moves an inch a year, which is not nearly fast enough.
Yeah. You can't just use, like, you can't just start putting hashtag things on the screen.
We used a hashtag. Current. We're 2020 now, right? Right?
Yeah. A hashtag that no one gives a shit about. Yeah. And then all the stronger together messaging and what, like, we don't give a shit. It's motorcycle racing, okay? No one wants to connect motorcycle racing and any kind of ideology or world messaging or whatever. All the messaging, all the anything you need is that people all over the world are watching it simultaneously. That's all you need. It is everything in that right there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the virtual fan wall was lame, but it was an attempt. But then at the same time, the press conference is still just a bunch of writers in front of a bunch of people in chairs asking the same six questions.
You know, I will defend the fan wall, the virtual fan wall, a little bit in that it shows that they were trying. And it was a little bit of a more common trend in the streaming area. You know, there was kind of a thing on Twitch for a long time, for a lot of esports, actually. So that was kind of a big leap for Dorna. Ultimately, it's something that's very easy to do, and it's not it's not technically complicated, but it was a big cultural leap for Dorna. And I'm going to give them credit for that.
Yeah. Okay, but here's something that they could do with the tech that would be really interesting. What if you sort of put in a kind of reality TV sort of aspect, or what do they call them? Like the asides or something in like the docu-style sitcoms. What if, as the race was happening, there was the live version with the live commentary or whatever version of the live commentary you want, but there was a sort of next day version as well, where they took all the big moments in the race, and then as those things have happened or are happening or just happened, the rider appears, you know, the riders involved in that event on the track appear in the corner. And if you want to turn on the button for them to talk, they can go, "So here's what just happened right there."
Oh, just like a director's commentary?
Yeah, so, yeah, like you have a big moat. Like, what if, you know, for like the Sepang Clash or something, you had a version of that race where you could click on a commentary done after the race, but included as it's playing in front of you, where Rossi goes, "So right here, you know, Marquez did this to me, so I went back with that." Then it switches to Marquez giving his point of view, right? So as you're watching the race, you know, it's days later, so the riders can tell you what was going through their head as that happened.
I really like that.
It's difficult to put together. You couldn't put it together for every race, but big races where big events happen, that's totally something where you can sit down with the riders and say, play them like a 10-second clip and go, "All right, now we want you to talk about what just happened right there."
Well, they can do more than that. But, I mean, essentially, like, every time you've gotten this experience in documentary form, it's always somebody doing it on tape after the fact.
Right.
But you can do it immediately.
Right. So it's available the next day or 8 hours later or whatever.
Well, it could be 2 weeks later, but it would be amazing to integrate it at the source with the actual original feed. Yes. And have that be perfectly digitally archived forever.
Yeah, or just do it for, just start out doing it for one or two moments per race. You know? And yeah, just see where it goes. See if people like it. And then you can start incorporating more of it after the fact.
Well, no. Go absolute. Well, no. Because they don't care except for how much bandwidth is consumed. So have every rider do their own track that can be overlaid on the original race.
Oh, so you can just click on and off whatever riders are talking. Okay.
Right. Maybe you don't care what Ika Lekkerona is thinking about this particular race, but if you wanted to, it's there.
Yeah, I mean, these racers go back and watch it all anyway.
Yeah, so why not just have it, you know, for whatever they want to say, they can submit a clip perfectly timestamped and integrated into the original feed.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah, I don't know. No one's going to listen to us. But this is what GP should do to make okay. I didn't know we were going to spend that much time on how GP should get with the times as far as the broadcasting goes. But, I mean, why not? This is the perfect time since we're kind of unsure what races are going to happen. Are there going to be traditional crowds or not? This is the perfect time to start playing with that stuff. Everyone's open to the format being changed up right now, right?
Yeah.
We've done everything from the NFL and NBA having fake audience noises to digital pictures of people being superimposed into the stands at baseball games, right? We've had the virtual fan wall in GP. We've had a lot more like weird animations just on the side of the track for sponsors and things. This is the time to keep playing with the format.
Yeah, just realize that you right now is the best time to make mistakes.
Yes. There we go. All right, cool. Let's move on to emails. You got any emails pulled up there? Or do we need to buy time?
We need to buy some time.
Okay, let's, before you do that anymore, one sec. All right, so here we go. Swigs is going to give us, for the first time in a few weeks, a real proper Swiggy Reads the Emails Drunk. I know you won't disappoint us. Who's our first email?
So our first email is from Matt. And this is a response to the Motorcycle Fads episode. And he says, the tail tidy fad is alive and well. And for everybody who is not living in the UK or Australia, the tail tidy is synonymous with the fender eliminator kit. And he says, at least in Australia and parts of Europe, I'm in a...
Yes, you have been drinking. Okay. You're in a what?
No, he's used some clever notation here. He's done star pillin for svart pillin / vit pillin.
Yes.
Owners group on Facebook, and the majority tend to be the 400s, though there's a bunch of 700s and a few 250s, but it seems like even with amazing attention to detail and design, where the stock exhaust flows into other lines, people will still put slip-ons on. There seems to be a general consensus against the wheel hugger fender too for some reason. Heaps of people are removing them and swapping them out for $150 tail tidies that amount to a bent piece of aluminum and a few bolts. None of them look like they will fit well, and yet people love them. One complaint I see about the hugger is people say they're heavy, in parentheses, couple of kilos, and of course it's unsprung mass. But then people also choose heavier spoked rims for the look. So I'm out of ideas. Keep it up as always, Matt. Now, I've come to a revelation recently on the whole fender eliminator concept. And you know, if you think about this for yourself, if you've gotten into riding and you didn't get into this idea, you might be pressured into it. But ultimately, when you're on the bike, it doesn't matter to you. Like, intrinsically, unless you're very, very focused on how the subframe of your bike looks, this is not important to you. Unless you're deeply concerned about what other people think. In a world of which the vast, vast majority of people will not care.
Right. They don't notice. They're not clued in into the subtleties of that, right? So I think of it this way. Think about how much you, as a motorcyclist and not a scooter rider, a scooterist, just kind of think all Vespas look exactly the same. And scooter people will look at a Vespa and know exactly what it is. They're clued into the little details that really let you know. But to a lot of people, just, they all look the same. They'll look at a P200 and go, oh yeah, that looks like an old, you know, super, you know, 60s Vespa or something. It's like, no. That's a much later design.
This is where I've figured it out.
So
I've got the answer for you. The Fender Eliminator Kit is the motorcycle equivalent of anal bleaching.
Yeah, it is.
Nobody cares. Hopefully, exactly one person might care.
Yeah.
But that's it. If you think about all the cars you pass, all the cars that pass you, all the motorcycles that pass you, which you can probably count on one hand on your commute, how many care and identify that you've put this super slick mod on your motorcycle to make your turn signals and your brake light less visible? Maybe in the year, there's one or two people. And why are you doing this? And also, is this a healthy behavior? And is this a worthwhile investment? I'm going to guess no.
Anal bleaching. It's perfect. Okay. I don't think there's anything else we can say on the topic. Oh, well, the only thing I was going to say is with the argument of its unsprung weight, I don't care which motorcycle you have. When it comes to the total amount, the total volume of unsprung mass that you have and your horsepower to weight ratio, no matter what it is on whatever bike you've got, it is what Honda Civic Type R guys beat off to at night. In terms of the ratios they would like to have. You've already won. The wheel hugger is fine. It's not ruining your ride.
Are you racing for money? No? Shut the fuck up.
There we go. I think they look cool, but whatever. Okay.
I like
them. So, what's our next email?
We have Peter.
Serial emailer.
Yes. And he says, "Hey, Pete and Swigs, burying the lead on the GTS 1000.
So, yeah, as he's a serial emailer, he sent us an email a couple weeks ago, you'll recall, and he threw in there that he was riding the Yamaha GTS 1000, their weird, insanely overpriced center hub steering, Omega frame, 1 liter super. Super sport tour, I guess is a term for it. Great sure. Big expensive thing. Yeah. And we were like, hold on, mate. What, you were riding one of the, what's the story? So here is the story.
Well, for additional clarification, we should point out that the GTS 1000 was one of our worst bikes in the world. Which was the super sport with the hub steering from Yamaha.
Oh, it was really more of a sport tour, I think, than a super sport. It's a 1 liter sport bike, but it was kind of...
It was in its own class of weird.
Right. It's kind of like an FJR with center hub steering, sort of. But it was the worst bike in the world, but like one of the worst bikes in the world that we actually like.
Well, that we wanted to succeed.
Well, I would be so stoked to own one, but I understand that it's a disaster.
Right.
Okay.
So he says, I only had it for about 45 minutes on a Yamaha launch. Most of the day was proving how slow I lapped Phillip Island on the FCR 750 of that year, the one with six piston brake calipers. That front straight into turn one, FARC. Which, you'll figure it out. Okay. One issue with the GTS 1000 experience is that the view from the seat doesn't match the visual impact from walking around it. The sport touring fairing, which I've described as 90s jet ski, blocks out any view of the cool stuff hanging off the front of the bike. So from behind the bars, it seems like you are on a pretty normie FJ 1200, wondering why you went into so much debt. The thing I really noticed at the front is the absolute lack of stiction compared with forks. It's much the same as riding a telelever on a BMW.
The front, yeah, that is, yeah, they accomplish almost exactly the same thing.
Right. The front wheel rides bumps without hesitation, despite the unsprung weight of the single-sided swing arm. Not sure if it's heavier or lighter than forks. On the telelever BMW, this stiction free ride up front really contrasts with a much slower response of the standard rear end. I wasn't able to ride... that's a different line. With its... On the telelever BMW, the stiction free ride up front really contrasts with the much slower response of the standard rear end with its heavy shaft drive and paralever hinge swing arm. I don't remember the GTS 1000 having quite so strong a front/rear contrast due to the double-sided swing arm and chain drive probably being a lot lighter. I wasn't able to run the GTS 1000 flat out through bumpy roads, exercising the brakes due to the fairly dull location, but that would have really been interesting. Otherwise, I mentioned previously how good the electronic ABS was compared with the hydraulic system that was still on the BMW of the time. The engine was detuned from the FCR 1000 donor bike, but I didn't get enough seat time to really focus on the engine. Seemed smooth, low vibes, and grunty, but if you stepped from an FCR 1000, you'd probably be disappointed on the throttle. So I think there is more car park and ride-by-wire than you would experience from the seat, but even in the car park, the bike looks horn from the rider's left side, from the swing. I don't know what that means.
Okay, so what he's saying is the idea of the bike is bigger than the experience of riding the bike.
Yeah.
Which is a problem. That this is something that happens with these. They're kind of like high concept bikes, right? So it's like when a movie's got a big gimmick, but it doesn't really fully pay off, right? You know, like Speed 2, right? Well, this time they're on a boat. It's Speed on a boat, right? It doesn't really pay off very well.
Yeah.
So stay with me. So
no. No, you're just building up a lot. You're just drawing upon a lot of trauma.
So the bike has some conventional things. It has this one really – if you go back and listen to our best worst bike on it, there's a lot of weird stuff to this bike. But the big one is the front end. And he's saying, well, you could just kind of be – you could just think you were riding a sort of, you know, late 90s FJR kind of bike if you didn't know any better.
Right.
It's not really anything to write home about, just riding it around. Now, I'll say this is one thing that the Nikon actually does well. The Nikon has this one big gimmick, and it really squeezes the lemon on that gimmick, right? When you're riding the Nikon,
there's no mistake that you're riding a Nikon.
Exactly.
You will never forget that you're riding a Nikon.
The front is so gigantic, and you can just see moving in front of you this thing. There are journalists that have said, oh, when you ride it, you could just be like looking off into the distance and think you're riding a regular motorcycle.
Fuck
bullshit.
Off. Yeah.
Bullshit. I have ridden it. Okay. I have hit potholes in it. I have. No, you are absolutely aware. And of course, you would want to be, right? This is what you bought. This is what you paid for. This is what you should want, to know that you're riding that, right? That is the one thing with the Neekin that should be a takeaway for designers. Okay, if you're gonna go for this big gimmick, make it pay off. Make it pay off in the experience. I mean, maybe that's why no one thought that the GTS 1000 was worth the money, because it was. You know, it's kind of like you said with the V, like not the V2. What was the HP4? You're like, it's not just expensive, it's mind-bogglingly expensive. Yeah. Right, the GTS was really stupidly priced, and I mean that's just what it cost to make it. But maybe if the experience of it was something that different, more people would have paid for it. I don't know. That's a history what if, right?
Well, no, that's just like pure performance and expense as opposed to a new concept.
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, the HP4 is just straight up retarded in just the amount of carbon fiber. The amount of structural carbon fiber in that bike is ridiculous.
Well, the HP4 isn't, well, yeah, but you know you're riding the HP4 because it's so light and all those things. It's basically BMW's Superleggera, right?
Ducati's.
No, BMW makes the HP4.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Brain fart, yes.
You're aware you're riding it. It pays off, right?
Yeah.
You're saying the GTS didn't. Okay. And next email.
Okay. And then we've got an email from Sean, who says, "Hello and greetings from North Vancouver, British Columbia. Coincidentally, we too have 300 sunny days here as well. I've had a chance to listen to a good number of your podcasts while I complete all the finishing carpentry in a house I'm building, and feel you guys have one of, if not the best MC podcasts, along with This Motorcycle Life. I just want to let you know you were spot on with most of your observations re cheap behavior by some motorcyclists. I gotta say, though, you're a little out of touch regarding the whole hippo hands thing. I am too cheap to buy real hippo hands, so instead opted for Tusk brand fleece-lined knockoffs. The thing is, I've owned Gore-Tex riding gloves, Oxford heated grips, and these $18 Tusk overmitts. The overmitts are the best bang for buck by far, and on their own, the most effective. The best combination is heated grips and the Tusk overmitts. The way I see it, there are only two things that will keep you dry, a roof or rubber. Wearing Gore-Tex gloves alone is like standing out in the rain while you're camping, sure, and you're going to be dry-ish, but everything around you will be wet and cold. Having overmitts is like having a tarp spread out over your campsite. It's better in all ways, except everything has a weird blue tint under the tarp. Your grips and controls will be dry, and you don't have to deal with wind blowing over your hands at 100 kilometers an hour, which only makes your hands even colder. If you're like me and ride a dual sport, you've got bark busters anyway, so they give form to the overmitts. I installed some grommets on my overmitts so I can fix them to the aluminum bark busters with some 8mm nuts. I usually leave the overmitts off as it's above 10 degrees Celsius, but can put them out of my panniers and put them on over the barkbusters in a matter of minutes if I see rain coming. A cheap but useful hack I also use when it starts to pour through a 400 kilometer ride includes taking my boots off and slipping my feet into plastic bags before putting the boots back on. Okay. Confirmed cheap biker.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Gore-Tex, but I'm yet to see a Gore-Tex boot with a motocross and not a lugged adventure style soul. I've ridden a fair number of miles in both my BMW Pro Rain Suit 2 and two-piece PVC yellow construction rain gear. Both do a good job of keeping you dry and warm, and cut down remarkably on wind chill. Anyway, I used to scoff at overmits, but I have since changed my tune. They're ugly, but they work. Keep up the good work, Clancy.
Okay, couple things. First of all, thank you for your high opinion of the show, and you're even more correct about this motorcycle life. Now, I feel like you really just proved all of our points that we made it out over with. Okay, so hear me out here. First of all, the point I said wasn't that the concept of the overmits was garbage and that they don't work. It was really that just in practice of almost all cases, it was a disaster. As I said, I don't believe that anyone in the last 25 years in a first world nation has used any legal currency to buy hippo hands. Yeah. Which you proved by buying the knockoffs. I mean, you should have gone a step further.
It's really part of the shadow economy at this point.
Yeah. I'm surprised you didn't buy them in Canadian Tire dollars. But so it's not a big shocker to me that when combined in the very specific case that they're combined with Bark Busters, Gore-Tex gloves, and heated grips, this is working out effective for you. How could it not, right? And you know what? You're doing exactly what you should be doing, and you've got your season is extended because your hands are warm and toasty, and more power to you. But in general, right, you know, buying we're talking about the person that inherits the hippo hands or inherits the fake hippo hands and does that instead of buying Gore-Tex gloves, instead of getting heated grips. You tripled down and did all the things to keep your hands warm. The cheap biker is the one that goes, oh, I've got to do something about my cold hands.
Honestly,
I'm going to buy like this $10 knockoff pair, or much more likely call my buddy who knows where someone has a pair not being used. And I'm just going to have a go at this.
If you took Bark Busters out of the equation and you were riding down the highway below freezing, and you had the choice of swapping out your current gloves for Gore-Tex gloves, or having heated grips, or Bark Busters, I'd go for the Bark Busters every time.
You left out the mitts in that equation. You said Bark Busters twice, but I think people know where you're
going. The Bark Busters instead of the mitts.
Yeah, of course. Yes, I know.
I think the Bark Busters are almost as good as the mitts.
Yeah, because he's right. You're stopping wind going over your hands, which is the number one thing that's going to make you cold.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been a long time since I've said this on the podcast, but there's only two elements to staying warm passively, which is a completely windproof layer combined with insulation.
Yes.
Ideally, you want wool under rubber or something like that. You want a completely impermeable layer outside and something that's trapping air underneath. Anything else that is not powered
would be uncivilized.
Is voodoo magic, and it doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, so in this very specific instance where you already have Bark Busters, where you've got heated grips, where you specifically were not cheap, Yes, this is effective. Almost all the time in practice, when someone doesn't even purchase the knockoff pair, they inherit a pair of Barkbusters. This is a cheap biker disaster move because, yes, it stops some air, but again, they're not, this cheap biker's not going to have good gloves. They're sure as shit not going to have heated grips, and they're not going to have Barkbusters, and they're going to try to ride at speed, and they're going to be pressing in their clutch and brake levers as a result, or fighting against it with their fingers, and I don't know who can enjoy riding that way.
Look, I'm sure that there is a very good way to set up Barkbusters on your particular bike exactly the way you want them to be set up, and they'll be safe, and they'll be warm, and it'll be great. But I'm going to guess that there's less than 1,000 people per year in the U.S. who actually do this.
Yeah, again, you meant to say bar mitts there instead of Barkbusters, but we're following you.
Okay. Yeah, it's fine.
All right, and I guess it's just the email that was sent to me now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we got an email from a certain listener targeting another listener. And so we have to relay a message. But I guess we probably shouldn't specifically call out this listener. But there's someone that probably should be purchasing a project bike for another person in their life. And specifically, the vehicle should be some sort of Honda with a flat single air-cooled engine, 50 to 70 to 90 cc's with leg shields. The designation of the model should start with a C. And the name of the bike, after the model designation, can start with a C. As long as it conforms to these, this person would very, very much like a project motorcycle. Okay? And I think you'll be doing well to make that person very happy should you purchase this. And that goes for everyone. You know, I think everyone should be buying a Super Cub or a Shally or something as a little quarantine project motorcycle to take up the fourth motorcycle spot in your garage that's currently sitting empty because you're already taking up two of them with your Triumph and your Harley. That's as cryptic as I can be and get this message across. So, let's see. Anything else we need to close out this episode?
Send us emails at contact@nokomotopodcast.com. And otherwise, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, okay. Everyone, please tell a friend about the show. Leave a rating and review somewhere if you can. They do things for us, but really tell a friend about the show. And we're going to remind everyone to stay safe, stay tuned, keep fighting the dragon, and let's sign out.
And I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Tail tidy kits are moto anal bleaching.